And the first case set for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Aaron Noteboom. For the appellant, we have Mr. Timothy Whalen, an attorney from Lake Andes. And for the State of South Dakota, we have Mr. Gary Campbell, who's an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Whalen, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, Your Honor, this case, as you probably are aware from the review of my brief, is a DWI case, which stems from the stop, detention, and subsequent arrest of my client, Aaron Noteboom, in Douglas County, South Dakota. In that case, briefly from a factual standpoint, my client was observed by officers approximately a quarter mile away as the crow flies on a rural Douglas County road. The only thing the officers observed at the time were headlights. Based upon this observation, the officers proceeded to the location where they saw the headlights, subsequently entered upon private property, flushed my client from behind trees and other obstacles on the property, and my client was arrested for a DUI.
They didn't actually see him, the headlights, go into the private property, right? Didn't they see tracks?
They did not. What happened, Your Honor, was that they observed the headlights and they did not see them come out to Highway 281, which was right close to Corsica, South Dakota. They subsequently went over to where they last saw the headlights and looked for this vehicle. They drove down this country road, turned around, came back, and the one officer, Troy Street, the deputy, indicated that he saw what he believed to be fresh tire tracks going into the private property. Now, what they indicated, the reason that they entered upon the private property and the reason that they went to look for this vehicle, they indicated, the officers at the suppression hearing and trial indicated, that they had received complaints about vandalism and trespassers on this property, and they utilized that fact as a basis to go onto the property and subsequently discover my client.
Right. I was just trying to correct what I thought was a wrong impression, that the officer followed the headlights into the vacant farmhouse.
Correct, Justice Sabers. That did not happen. They did not see the headlights reappear, and therefore they did not, you're absolutely correct, they did not follow the vehicle onto the private property. In fact, when they went to the location where they saw the vehicle, last saw the headlights, I should say, they searched for it because they were unable to find it. And I say they because Officer Banghart went to the same location as Officer Street. Now, at that point in time, the only thing that the officers observed were the headlights. They did not observe any vehicle violations. They didn't know how many occupants were in the vehicle. They didn't know the license plate. They didn't know the make, model. They knew absolutely nothing about this vehicle except that they were headlights. And that, after they had located the vehicle and at the suppression hearing, they testified that they had relied on complaints of vandalism and trespass on this property. Well, as you can see from the testimony that was produced in my brief, that was disproved by the defendant at the suppression hearing. Two people, one was a property owner and the other was closely associated with the property owner, testified that they had not made these alleged complaints of trespass and vandalism. They also testified, the witnesses for the defendant testified that they did not, they weren't aware of any problems there. They hadn't told officers of any problems at this location. The trial court specifically found that there was no credibility to the officer's testimony and the reliance on the alleged complaints of trespass and vandalism.
Well, then how did the trial court resolve the issue in favor of the state if it said the officers aren't credible?
They relied on the totality of the circumstances analysis, Your Honor, which is what this court has approved with regard to Fourth Amendment issues and when interpreting and applying the Fourth Amendment. The totality of the circumstances utilized by the trial court, Justice Gilbertson, was that in light of the fact that we're in rural South Dakota, we're in a low-crime area, and the officers at 2 o'clock in the morning observe headlights on a road, they should have and have a duty to go and see what those headlights are up to. And that's the gist, that is the thrust of my argument, is that the totality of the circumstances is not appropriate and does not give the court the privilege of reaching that decision that justifies the intrusion in this case.
How about when the officers get to the point of where they think the lights have, headlights have disappeared, and then they see these fresh tracks going into the vacant farmhouse or vacant farmyard? How about that as reasonable cause to inspect further?
I would associate that, Your Honor, with the cases, I believe it's Webb and Graff, where the anonymous tip was not substantially corroborated or substantiated by the officer's investigation. Here, those tracks could have very well been tracks coming out of that property. They could have been tracks made by the owners of the property. And consequently, there was no reason for the officers to go on to that property.
But isn't the question here the stop, not the investigation? There wasn't anything illegal about the police officers going on to this property to inspect. What may have been illegal was the stop of the vehicle.
I disagree, Your Honor. I believe that they were acting illegally when they went on the property. You have to have, under the Fourth Amendment and under our law, you have to have a reason to enter upon private property to look for something.
But why does your client have standing to even raise that issue? It wasn't his property.
Because the stop must be legitimate and justified at its inception. And then here, in this case, the stop was not justified and legitimate at its inception because the officers only saw headlights and reacted to the headlights.
But they didn't stop him on private property. They stopped him on a public road.
They did, Your Honor, but they flushed him from private property. Had the officers not went on to the private property, they would not have moved my client from the private property.
But isn't it an officer's obligation to protect private property? And if they think that there's something suspicious going on? I mean, what if somebody sees a burglar climbing in a window? Is the officer supposed to say, well, I can't go on that property because it's private?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And under that circumstance, I agree with you wholeheartedly. The officer should respond. But there's something illegal happening. Here, there was nothing illegal happening. I like
how does the officer know that? And I mean, the officer's in the process of an investigation, and your client has not, his rights haven't been intruded upon at all when the officer drives up this private driveway. So why isn't that a part of the investigation?
That isn't a part of the investigation, Your Honor, because there must be some illegality or wrongful conduct or something that causes the officer to investigate. Here there was nothing.
Say officers walk the beat a lot up and down main streets in South Dakota. If an officer finds an unlocked door at night, he doesn't have the legal authority to go into that building and find out what's going on.
That's a different scenario, Your Honor. That's an unlocked door to a business, and that is appropriate. We're not talking about a locked building. We're talking about a property that is storage buildings with a circular half-moon driveway into it. There's no reason for the officer to be suspicious of anything happening. And that's the thrust of this case. In every case that you've decided and in every case that has been cited by the state, there was some illegality or something amiss that caused the officers to do the things they did in order to get in a position to discover the criminal activity. The case from Yankton, the Herbold case, they're investigating a robbery and a person drives by and he honks several times and waves out the window. As this court concluded, he's inviting the investigation by the officers. Is this what quite often happens in criminal activity, burglaries? The defendant returns or the perpetrator returns to the scene of their crime to see what's going on. That was something unusual, suspicious, or illegal, or wrongful that occurred that caused the officers to pursue. Here, nothing like that happened. It's the very same case, Your Honor, if everyone in this courtroom decided tonight that I'm leaving and I'm going home, as soon as I get in my car and I turn my headlights on, I've created reasonable suspicion to stop, for an officer to stop me. That's where we need to draw the line here, Your Honors. There needs to be a line that stops the reasonable suspicion from going to a point where it is completely unreasonable.
Now, my recollection is that the officer's testimony was that they saw fresh tracks going in to the vacant property. Now, you claim that it could have been the property owner And they said that there was a sprinkle or a rain before this, and that's what caused the fresh tracks. But it's my thought, or it's my impression from reviewing this, that they said they saw these fresh tracks going into the property, and I assume they could tell whether or not the tracks, by the markings they make, are going in or coming out. For one thing, you know, you would go in like this, and you would come out and probably go the other way or swing around like this, so the tracks would be different, even if you weren't looking at the details of the tracks. So why isn't that something suspicious or something to raise a flag to cause them to go in?
If I drive into my driveway, Your Honor, with my lights on, have I now created reasonable suspicion for an officer to stop me and investigate to determine whether or not I'm driving under the influence? No.
It seems like to me, though, you're using the approach that the United States Supreme Court has condemned unanimously. And this was, you know, United States versus Arvizu was a unanimous decision where the Ninth Circuit used the divide-and-conquer approach, where they looked at each fact individually and they said, well, this clue doesn't prove anything, so that can't be enough. This clue doesn't prove anything. But aren't law enforcement officers who are trained to make deductions about various activities, aren't they entitled to aggregate all those clues in order to decide whether there's some kind of suspicious activity?
They are, Your Honor, but in this case, and that's the totality of the circumstances approach I believe the trial court used, and in this case, when you take those, the aggregate of all the facts that they knew, bearing in mind that the trial court disbelieved and threw out the alleged complaints of misconduct, what do we have left? We have headlights and tracks going on to private property. Even that, considered in the totality of the circumstances, doesn't give the officers a reasonable suspicion at its inception.
What do you say to this, though? You know, getting past the driveway issue, now we have the officer going up this driveway, he sees the car, the lights are turned off, and as soon as the officer gets there, the lights are turned back on and the car leaves. This is what the United States Supreme Court said in Peters versus New York. Deliberate furtive actions and flight at the approach of strangers or law officers are strong indicia of mens rea, guilty knowledge.
That, Your Honor, is true. But in that case, if I remember correctly, and I may be wrong, the officers had seen the vehicle. They did not just stumble upon the vehicle. In this case, the officers did not know the vehicle was on this property. They were unaware of it being there. If the situation is such where the officers see the vehicle, it's stopped, they turn around to come to it, and the vehicle takes off, that's a whole different situation. So that case is distinguishable, Your Honor, on that fact alone. And that's my position with regard to the piecemeal approach as well. And I do believe that I'm trying to apply the totality of the circumstances argument in this case, Your Honors, in the sense that taking into consideration what the officers had, it is akin to the cases that you have decided were not sufficient reasonable suspicion. And again, I believe it's Graff and Webb, where the court indicated that there was insufficient evidence that the officer had and knew about to justify the reasonable suspicion and the stop.
Now, there's two officers involved in this, and they don't communicate back and forth well during this whole process. Do we take their observations of both officers in the totality of the circumstances, or only the officer that actually made the stop?
I believe the fellow officer rule would apply in this situation in that regard, even though they did not communicate. I believe that the transcript and the evidence shows that they were both located at the same place in Corsica and at the same time observed the headlights and then went separate ways so as to meet up at the location where they observed the headlights. And so in that regard, I think the totality of the circumstances situation would still apply. And given that application, I still believe that the totality of the circumstances analysis is in the evidence is insufficient, Justice Meyer Henry, to indicate that they in fact had a reasonable basis for further investigation onto the private property.
What on this private property, can you tell us a little bit more about it? It says it's a storage area. Was it a vacant farmhouse, as Justice Saver said?
It wasn't a vacant farmhouse. It was the only thing located there, Your Honor, were storage bins. And there were a set of trees, if I can describe appropriately, between the road, 274th Street, and then the Half Moon driveway. And then the storage buildings were situated on the other side of the Half Moon driveway. So from the road, as you looked into the property, you could not see anything beyond the tree belt between the Half Moon driveway and the road. So the view of the officers, and I believe the officers testified at the hearing that they did not see the vehicle on this property.
Let's assume for a minute that the officers just, you know, they're sitting around in Corsica and they get bored at 2:00 in the morning, and so they always make a routine run through this Half Moon driveway. And what if they do that and in the process, this night, they flush this driver who's sitting in there with his lights off and he takes off? Is that enough furtiveness to qualify for Justice Konenkamp's case that he referred to?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and the reason I say that is because this property is not located within the city limits. It is within the 1 mile extended jurisdiction of the officers. And in that area, officers routinely and quite frankly regularly do not patrol. So I think the hypothetical that you pose is not appropriate because the officers are not in a position to be routinely patrolling this area anyway.
Don't we have a deputy sheriff here and a city police department officer?
We do, Your Honor. And given if we take the deputy sheriff and we look at the routine patrol of the deputy sheriff, no, I don't believe that that is appropriate because nothing that I'm aware of in the law allows a deputy sheriff to drive onto a private farm property for purposes of merely looking and seeing what's going on. That is different than driving down a public street on Main Street, Corsica, and looking at buildings to see whether or not there's any activity in them. Bear in mind, whenever an officer patrols in a city or in a county, they do not leave the public roadway to go and check private properties.
Well, that isn't true in the case that Justice Gilbertson brought up about an officer walks down the sidewalk and then he steps onto private property and he checks and see if the door is locked to a building.
Well, in my building, Your Honor, I own up to the sidewalk. And so the officer is on the sidewalk to reach over and check the door. He's still on public property. That sidewalk, although I have to maintain it, is nonetheless public access property. People can protest my business. In fact, they have in front of my building, and there's nothing I can do about it. That's the difference between actually entering onto private property in the scenario that Justice Konenkamp.
Well, I know, but we're fighting over peanuts here, it seems to me. What if there's an entrance to the building, and we're not talking about your building, but a different building, and there's an entrance, which is clearly the private property, away from the sidewalk. The officer walks across the entranceway and checks to see if the key is locked, to see if the door is locked.
That scenario is a minimal intrusion, and it is something that perhaps is invited by the local businesses. It's something that perhaps the city council encourages. But there you're talking about a business with valuables in it. In light of the fact that there's a business with valuables in it, that's a different scenario than a vacant farm lot. And so I don't agree with the hypothetical that it applies in this case because I don't believe officers have a right to go on to a farm lot, a farm property, to see what's going on. In a business, they're checking to see if there's been any break-ins, and if they check the handle, there's no intrusion into the building. There may be an arm reach or a step over the threshold to see whether or not the door's locked, but that intrusion is wholly different than the violation of my client's constitutional right to be free from unreasonable search and seizures, as indicated in this case. So I think what we have are, we're comparing apples and oranges in those scenarios. You have a private farm property that you must drive on in order to see whether or not anybody's there, and you have an arm reach to see if a door's locked. I think they're wholly different, and they're as I said, apples and oranges.
Let me ask you about one other thing before you run out of time. I'm troubled by the conflict in the court's decision, the memorandum decision, and finding of fact 10. They appear to be in conflict over the question of whether there were complaints made about watching this property.
I believe, Your Honor, that and in fact that is one of the discrepancies that I point out as being why the trial court's findings of facts were clearly erroneous.
Well, no,
because there was a clear discrepancy, as you said.
Our rule is that the findings generally control, but in this case, the court incorporated its memorandum decision into the findings. So, which set do we go by?
That's a very good question, Your Honor, and that is one of my arguments. If the trial court is confused in regard to which set of facts apply, then there's clearly an erroneous decision. In its memorandum decision, there was no question the trial court just did not. May I continue?
Yes.
There's no question the trial court did not believe the officers. But in the findings of fact that were signed by the trial court, it indicated that there were complaints. That's the very basis for my contention with regard to the findings of facts and the decision of the trial court.
Your time has expired, Mr. Whalen. Thank you. Mr. Campbell, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I thank the court for this opportunity to address Mr. Whalen's arguments. To begin with, just to take things a bit out of order, I'd like to address the question of the supposed conflict that Justice Zinter raised between the trial court's letter opinion and its findings of fact and conclusions of law. The findings of fact and conclusions of law don't say that the trial court believed the officer's testimony regarding the reports of vandalism or theft out of the property. It just says that they testified to it. Now, at the end, the trial court writes in his own handwriting that he incorporates the earlier letter opinion. The letter opinion is what is where the court indicated that it didn't accept the state's testimony regarding those reports. So I don't see that there is an actual conflict. In the findings of fact, the court says they testified to this. In the letter opinion, which is incorporated right after that, it says that he doesn't accept that testimony. So the bottom line is that we're left with the trial courts rejecting the testimony based on the conflict with the owners. Well, the one owner that came in and the defendant's father's testimony, that one of the other owners had told him there had been no such problems or reports. Now, going back to the beginning of the case, now you have Deputy Streed saying that about 1:45 a.m., he sees these headlights traveling down the road, which goes east-west, just south of Corsica. He's within a quarter mile, half a mile. He sees the headlights going towards Highway 281, which is what he's on, which is the main street going north and south. He sees the headlights go behind an obstruction. I think it's a rise in the ground. And, of course, they disappear because the line of sight is obstructed. But the lights never come out of that obstruction. They never continue down the road. It just ends right there. So he takes off to go down and see what happened to the car, see what's going on. Now, the chief of police, Marty Banghart, was nearby in a separate car. He wasn't with Deputy Street. He sees the same thing. He takes off, goes down there shortly after the deputy did. The deputy goes down to the intersection with 281 and this crossing road, turns down the crossing road towards where he saw the lights disappear. He travels down a distance to Napoleon Avenue, which is the next road down, Napoleon and Corsica, well, it kind of fits. Hasn't seen the car, turns around and comes back, and as he's coming back, he sees at one of the entrances of a semicircular driveway, these tracks through wet ground. And I don't believe that he could actually tell whether they're incoming or outgoing. That, I think, Mr. Whalen dealt with on cross-examination. But there's one set of tracks. That's it. He decides to go in and check it out. As he's going around the semicircular driveway, he still can't see the defendant's car. He gets within about, comes around the curve, I think he said he was within approximately 25 feet when he sees the car. Lights are off. The lights come on. The car starts driving away. He's following the car. Right, the defendant who was in the car goes down the other leg of the driveway to the road, turns onto the road, at which point Chief of Police Banghart comes down the road, sees him pulling out with the car, the deputy's car behind him, and initiates the stop. He explained,
is there any testimony, talk about furtive, whether or not it was furtive, is there any testimony in the hearing about that it was sudden or furtive? I don't recall that. I mean, he turned the light on.
Well, he didn't patch out. He didn't hit the accelerator and gun it out of there. But the lights came on and the car immediately starts moving out. I think the furtiveness here isn't so much the car's leaving, but the position of the car in the first place. It's in a place that's hidden from the road. Now, why is a car traveling down what's essentially a deserted highway at 1:45 in the morning, pulling off onto a private property, and in effect hiding behind a screen of trees or bushes or whatever they were? That I think is very odd. I think the officers had every right to go down into that area and look for that vehicle. If you look at State v. Reinhardt, officers were entitled to stop a car because it was driving, I think, 20 to 25 in a 40-mile-per-hour zone.
Was that on private property, though?
Isn't the
problem here the private property?
Well, I don't think it is a problem, because officers are entitled to go on to private property in the course of their duties. This was in the course of their duties. They don't know when those headlights disappear and they can't find the car what has happened. The car may be wrecked in the ditch. Well, they drive by, they don't see it. Where has the car gone? They don't know whether there's a problem with the car, a problem with the driver, or if there's criminal action afoot.
But they did not articulate that. Don't they have to articulate that if that was their concern? I mean, we're putting words into their mouths. Doesn't the officer himself, isn't that the standard that we use? They have to articulate why they were doing it. Now, you're adding to that. There was no testimony as to that.
Well, Your
Honor,
that
they were concerned about the safety of the car,
no,
or the driver. That was, in fact, they testified. They thought about something that the trial court did not believe. So, I mean, yes, we can add all those things, and I'm sure you'd like to, but we have to stick with what they articulated.
There have to be reasonable and articulable justifications, but you don't look at the subjective mind of the officer. What the officer is actually thinking is not part of the totality of the circumstances test. As the Supreme Court pointed out in Arvizu, where it condemned the piecemeal approach that the Ninth Circuit was using, what one looks at is, would an officer in the position of those officers, knowing what they know, could he reasonably believe that the intrusion on the defendant's Fourth Amendment rights would be justified?
It's the reasonable officer standard, not the particular officer standard.
Right. It's
right.
Objective, not
right.
Subjective.
It's not this officer's standard. Would a reasonable officer find this activity suspicious? Not,
right.
But, you know, this case is unusual.
It is.
Because we have a judge saying that the officers were not credible. Both of them were not credible in some of the facts they gave as reasons for their investigation.
Right.
I haven't seen that before.
I haven't either.
So how do we factor that in? And what policy do we want to foster in whatever decision we make?
Well, we certainly don't want to encourage officers to to tell falsehoods. I mean, the state does not believe in that just as much as Mr. Whalen doesn't. What the trial court did, and what I think is correct, is that it looked at the circumstances and decided whether in the circumstances that were there, not the circumstances that the officers were talking about, but whether the circumstances before them were sufficient. And the trial court concluded that there was justification for the intrusion. I think that under the reasonable suspicion standard, the objective standard, that was sufficient. Now, it's not the strongest case in the world, but the officers had a situation where a car disappears in the dark of night with no they drive down the road, it's disappeared. Where is it? I think they have the duty, and I think Reinhardt indicates that they have a duty to investigate situations like that. Would a reasonable officer in that position just say, and drive away? I don't see any fault in the officers doing what they did as far as going out there to find out what was wrong in terms of going on to the property. That was in the performance that they did. Flight from the officers justifies the stop. Now, there's sort of an interesting point here in that if you have a carry stop that an individual can just, refuse to talk to the officer. Now, the interaction between that and Wardlow is interesting. I think that under Wardlow, the officers are justified. And the difference is between a case where the citizen just turns around and walks away from the officer without talking, is that here there are reasons for the officer's suspicion. The reason for the officer's suspicion is the location, the name, and the fact that there really is no reason for the defendant to be there.
Well, Mr. Campbell, that raises another issue about this case that's very unusual, and that is when you read the cases, hundreds of cases in this area, usually we have the opposite situation where the officers are justified because it's a high crime, and that's usually been the linchpin for many of the court decisions justifying an investigatory stop. Because it's a high crime area. We just decided the Belfouche case very recently where there was recent burglaries. And so the rationale for justifying the stop was that there's a good reason because it's high crime. Here we're going to say the opposite. You're asking us to say the opposite. That because it's a low crime area, it should justify the stop. And it doesn't seem right that we should say the same thing when we have opposite facts.
Well, I think the way to deal with that is to put in the perspective of it's the totality of the circumstances. And an area being a high crime area or where the recent reports are, that's one circumstance that certainly affects the balance between the intrusion and the stage reasons for the intrusion.
Say that this had occurred in course ago. See a car go around the corner and don't see it again. Does that give the officers the right to start going into the backyard and driveway just trying to figure out where those lights went?
I think if it was in town, it would be a different situation. It's sort of like there are many cases, including U.S. Supreme Court cases, where they've rejected the idea of just because a person is in a high crime area that it's that gives the officers reason to stop or to inquire. If you're in town, even if it's an area that has high crime, you've still got a right to be there, and it's to be expected that people will be there. It's not to be expected that cars are pulling off into this empty, closed business at 1:45 in the morning and turning off their lights. Now, there could be innocent reasons for that. But under Arvizu, the fact that there are innocent explanations does not completely counter the fact that there are reasons to be suspicious.
What about the testimony of the officers on cross-examination that they were doing it out of curiosity?
Again,
should we take that into consideration?
Again, that goes back to the objective versus the subjective parts of the totality of the circumstances test. I think when they go down there initially, whether they have any reason or not, they can do that. If they are private citizens, they could do it on their own. But, gee, where'd that car go? When they get down there and there's no vehicle, I think the situation changes. If they're down there initially for out of curiosity, then when the vehicle is not there, I think it escalates more into the reasonable suspicion area than simply idle whim, caprice, or curiosity. And again, when the car is not there, when the cars go in and nothing comes out and the officers drive there and there's nothing there on the road, then I think you're not talking about just curiosity. There's a mystery there to be looked into, and I think the officers acted completely within the scope of their duties, their action for reason. And on that note, if there are no further questions, I'll return to the podium.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Whalen, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, Your Honors, I want to address one thing I want to address several things. First off, I think it's abundantly clear in this case that at its inception, the only reason the officers went over to where these headlights were out of idle curiosity. I can think of no better proof than the officer's testimony at suppression hearing. And that's very clear. I set forth the colloquy in my brief. It was based on curiosity. In his report, he said, "I was curious." I think with the officer saying that, we have no other conclusion to reach than that it was based on, the initial inception was based out of idle curiosity.
Do you agree with the state that we really shouldn't pay any, what the officers say or their subjective reasons should not be considered here?
No, I understand the subjective versus objective analysis here, and I think one of the justices indicated earlier that the objective standard is what an officer in a similar situation would have done. I think that the subjective, if you look at what the officer subjectively believed or what they knew, based upon the trial court's conclusion. They didn't know anything except for the fact that there were headlights on this road. And if we want to put ourselves in the officer's shoes to see whether or not this is an objectively reasonable, they knew that there was a car on the road at 2 o'clock in the morning with headlights on. That's perfectly legal. That should be the case. If those headlights were off and they saw dust or they saw some other things going on, maybe they'd have a reason to go look at where this vehicle was. Justice Zinter, you indicated this was not a high crime rate area. If we're in a high crime rate area and you see lights and then you don't see them again, then perhaps we have some reason to go over and check these lights out. But so for what the officers knew, Justice Meyer-Henry, and the subjective versus the objective, I think under either scenario, we still don't have a reasonable intrusion at its inception versus, as you know, the two-part analysis was the stop justified at its inception, and were there circumstances that supported or justified further intrusion. So at its inception, I think this stop is not warranted.
So curiosity, unfortunately, to this case, the old saying, curiosity killed the cat, curiosity kills this case for the state. There is no basis for supporting it.
Well, there's a big difference between objective curiosity and idle curiosity.
Idle curiosity, I'm sitting at the gas station in Corsica looking around with nothing else to do, and I see lights, and I think I'll go check them out. Objective curiosity, there's dust coming from the road, there's headlights, and there's no longer headlights. I saw people running around. This is a high crime rate area. There were, in fact, complaints that have been made about crime in this area. Those are the objective facts that I think may support a conclusion that the stop was justified at its inception.
Let me ask you an unfair question. Just because I want to test you. I want to test your
okay.
knowledge. Well, keep in mind, I'm stipulating that it's a little unfair to ask this question, okay. but I want to hear your answer to it.
My wife asks them all the time.
All right, yeah. Well, keep in mind that the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly said that the touchstone for Fourth Amendment questions is reasonableness. Reasonableness. That's what the court looks at as the final test for whether a search or a stop is appropriate. Let's suppose now we have the same facts that we have in this case, and the officer sees the tracks, goes up the road, here's a car with no apparent business sitting up there with the lights off. The lights come on, and the car drives off. But then the officer follows your rule and doesn't stop him. And the next morning, they find the body of a dead child right where that car was sitting. Would it have been unreasonable for that officer to have at least checked out who was in that car before they let them drive off in a place where there was no business? And would that officer be subject to some criticism for not having made a reasonable decision that night when he let that car drive off?
I would be the first one to chastise that officer in that scenario for not doing his job, because that is so different than the facts we have here. Here you have a car on the road in plain sight, obviously headlights off, and the officer comes up to the location and he sees this and they turn the lights on and drive off.
I don't, you say different. The only fact that's different is the dead child found the next morning.
No, it's not.
The only fact.
No, Your Honor. The difference is, in our case, the car was not visible from the road. They could not see the car. They did not know it was on that
body. You're changing the fact.
No,
maybe
I guess
this is an impossible. Maybe I'm changing it unfair. Maybe it's even more unfair than I thought. But all I'm changing is one fact, and that is the next morning they find a child dead where that car had been sitting.
But that's, you didn't, Your Honor. I have to beg your pardon. Okay. You changed one very key fact. You put the car in plain sight on a public road.
No. I'm changing no facts but that one fact. That the next morning, they find this dead child. Every other fact is the same. And I'm asking you, would that officer be legitimately subject to criticism for not having made a reasonable decision in at least checking out what was going on with that car?
No. In that scenario, if we have the exact same facts we have here, but the only difference is that a dead child is found in the morning at that scene, they don't know that car is on that property, and they have no right to be on that property. The officer would not be unduly chastised, and I would not criticize him, because we have to look at, in answering your question, I need to point out, what are we trying to protect here? Are we trying to protect the officer's quote-unquote right to invade personal property? Are we trying to protect the citizen's right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures? We cannot throw out the Fourth Amendment in favor of police activity. The ends cannot justify the means. And consequently, what are we trying to protect? We're trying to protect my right and every citizen's right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures.
But your client has no right to be on this property. It's not his land.
Nobody knew that.
Don't they have a right to stop and ask?
Pardon me?
Don't they have a right then to stop and ask? Is this your land? Why are
no,
you
they
here?
Do not, Your Honor. That is not. There is no constitutional right for an officer to go on property. They first have to have probable cause. And before they can have probable cause, they must have reasonable suspicion.
Well,
no, sir, they cannot just come onto my... They do not have a right to come onto my property, nor anyone else's. It is a right that protects the people, not the police.
Right, correct. But if they see a car with lights on, and then they don't see it again, so they investigate, drive up and down the road, and then they are sitting out there, right outside the driveway, and... that now they don't see any car lights, and they see tracks going into this vacant property. The question is whether or not that's reasonable cause to give them the right to intrude on personal property. And, you know, I thought you were conceding earlier about, with Justice Konenkamp's example of the dead child, that that had been different, but I realized that there was a mix-up or a confusion on the facts. But the question then is whether or not it's reasonable. It's certainly more reasonable for the officer to go on and to check it out and see if the headlights, which are now off, are on that property, than it is for the individual to be on that property without his headlights on.
That, Your Honor, no, I disagree. And that's what you folks said in Webb and Graff. You said your reasonable suspicion is not unfettered. You must rein it in. You must be able to ascertain and articulate specific facts. And here the officers couldn't. How do they know that that wasn't the owner? How do they know that that person didn't have permission to be on that property? How do they know that that wasn't a cousin to the late deceased wife of Mr. Rexwinkle? They don't know that, and that's what Graff and Webb tell us, is you must be able to identify and articulate specific facts so as to justify your intrusion at its inception.
I just want to, I commend you for the answer you gave to my question, and we got it straightened out, because
I
think you've illustrated the problem we have to decide in this case, you know, the balance between law enforcement and individual rights. Which way does it tip in this case? And it's a close question, I concede to you, and I think your answer illustrates that for us very well.
Thank you. With that compliment, I'm going to end and sit down.
No, it doesn't get any better than that.
I can't, and I'm going to encourage this court to please reverse the trial court.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whalen.